Well, welcome back. Let's just do a little review. Just the main idea so far. The big thing is this difference between the spirit of the time and the spirit of the depths. That was presented to Jung so clearly when he compared the mood of the times versus his dreams view of the times. Mood of the times prior to World War I was gay and cheerful, a belief in unending progress, and then he dreams of catastrophe. So I think that's what struck him so forcibly in order and motivated him to make this distinction. We talked about the seeds of his future ideas, and I felt there were we've seen one main seed of his re-evaluating religion in him making the pursuit of meaning the religious life. And I called that his viewpoint based on epistemological criticism. Does that all sound familiar? We can't know God. We have an experience of God, and that experience changes in each generation or each epoch. And where we are now, according to his unconscious, is to see the sacred in life in our fulfilling our meaning. So he doesn't give up God, but he redefines what worship is, and he redefines what our understanding of God is. The other main theme, which we just touched on last time, and I'll read you just a little bit about it, is this business that God isn't conscious. Part of the problem, he feels, in our understanding of God is that we turn to God as a benevolence, and that's an error. God is both benevolent and malevolent, aware and unaware. What's that mean? It means that we have to supply the awareness that God lacks. I don't think it's an idea fundamentally at odds with Judaism, but it is at odds with Christianity. And a couple of quotes which I typed up, if you can remember that sheet that I emailed you a while ago. Take off from this last quote that we talked about on page 231. The one eye of the Godhead is blind, one ear of the Godhead is deaf. The order of its being is crossed by chaos. Everybody remember that? That's on page 231 there at the right before the section refining the soul. Say what? Where we are? Right before refining the soul. The one eye of the Godhead is blind.
Oh, the one who's cold.
The one ear of the Godhead is deaf. The order of its being is crossed by chaos. So be patient with the crippledness of the world and do not overvalue its consummate beauty. Well, that's the second. Remember, these are just voices he's hearing from the unconscious. Points of view, which he takes as a starting point for his psychology. And what he did then, out of that statement, was tailor his understanding of the self on that basis. So that leads to this idea that, you know, if you've done any dream work, you realize dreams aren't always trustworthy. What life brings you often needs to be questioned. You know, the typical naive Christian point of view says, well, it's God's will, and you accept it. And Jung's point of view is, well, it may be God's will, and I don't accept it, because I have a right to my own perception, and I have a right to value, because it's my life, you might say. So here are just a couple of quotes that came out of a sentence like this from the collected works. Page 2 of that sheet. This is now a formulation of that very cryptic sentence in later work. See at the bottom there of the page, it says page 231. Since Yahweh treated Job unjustly, and since that fact was registered consciously by Job, the crime that Yahweh committed against Job on account of this unconsciousness required rectification, required an answer. So Jung then turned to the book of Job to explicate this idea. And the idea is that God didn't know what he was doing in the book of Job. How could he make a deal with the devil? It didn't bother him at all, because the book of Job is about a deal with the devil. The devil puts the idea to Yahweh, and Yahweh agrees. Okay. This is Edinger now describing that idea. And Jung tells us in the book that Yahweh's answer to his unjust treatment of Job was, that should be his, was his incarnation as man. Since in his encounter with Yahweh, Job, as the image of humanity, had displayed a consciousness superior to Yahweh's, Yahweh was obliged to catch up with him morally, so to speak, and the answer was for Yahweh to become man. So there's Jung's description of Jung's later working out of that otherwise rather cryptic sentence. The one eye of the Godhead is blind, the one ear of the Godhead is deaf. Quote from Answer to Job. Job is no more than the outward occasion for the inward process of a dialectic in God. Does that make sense? You sure? No. Okay. Good. Somebody was honest. Again, the idea is that the self is, on the one hand, an astounding guide. On the other hand, a very dangerous foe. It's both at the same time. And what is required to be able to hear its guidance and not succumb to its demonic intent is that we question it. And that questioning has the effect of changing the self. So not only does the self guide us, we have a responsibility to negate the self's destructiveness, and in doing so, it transforms. And that's what it wants. It actually does not want to be listened to. It wants to be seen and challenged. Now, you can take that on many levels. You can take it simply psychologically as a statement about the self. You know, Jung never says the self is God. But he does say that it's a representation of we don't know what. He leaves it open that God does exist. So he also leaves open that in our dialogue with the self, we are having an effect on God. Might be a way to put it.
He's saying we don't know.
We don't know. But just as we don't know that it's true, we also don't know that it's false. Really, I don't think that concerned him. I throw that out because of the religious criticism he gets. I think he, as I, was satisfied saying, all we have is the image of the self, that's enough. Who knows what it refers to? What interests him, what interests me is, what's it doing in my life? What's it asking of me? But I just throw that out because I think there are religious implications here if you are living in that religious worldview. I personally am not.
Job thing is really like a metaphor for this.
Job is a metaphor between the ego and the self, for the relationship between the ego and the self. If you want to speak in religious terms, between the individual and God. And if you're dealing with jerks, a good metaphor for what a jerk is asking of you. A jerk is asking you to stop him or her. No, I don't accept your behavior. Go to hell. Our Christian sentiment is to be understanding and so on. But that is not what the activated dark self is in an individual who might be attacking you. In other words, you know, if you put this in pop psych language, what you are required to do with people who are acting out of the dark side of the self to you is to set a boundary. Understanding won't do it. A boundary setting is actually what is asked for. That's kind of mixing metaphors a little bit. And, you know, to your own darkness. You know, I mean,
could it also be a metaphor for our relationship to entities that are godlike in their feeling that
like hospitals? And arrogant doctors? Absolutely.
And healthcare as a whole system.
Yeah.
It's an entire system that has a deep unconscious.
Yeah, it's the healthcare system is like Yahweh.
Yeah.
I've just been finding that out. So you see, it becomes incredibly relevant. These are not just abstract philosophical discussions. The narcissistic personality of our time, which you hear all about, they're acting out of the dark side of the self. They're little gods demanding satisfaction. And the more you satisfy them, the more they attack.
The other time, last time it was time for me to talk about the Bashev's experience is...
Yeah.
When the power, one person is trying to overcome the other
right.
power.
Right.
And not, there's not a relationship.
Right.
And so that would be part of, that would be...
Absolutely. Thing. You could say Hitler or any fascist is acting out of the dark side of the self.
And I was thinking of, like in the olden times, there used to be the doctor would go to the church, and that's where the hospital was, and they had a relationship, and then through that relationship, the patient was healed somehow. And it's gotten so far away from that that you're ordered to do this and that, and fit in, and so no one's treated as an individual. And
right.
I'm thinking that
it's exactly the same thing.
Yeah.
Exactly the same thing.
Yeah. And also, I was thinking about the incident of Carmel,
which is that? The kids getting beat up, you mean? Or?
Yeah.
A kid's. Supposedly, allegedly, the FBI's investigating, but one of the boys on the basketball team, Hayes, thought it to be a and it's just awful. Mm-hmm. On a school bus, I don't know, from a basketball game, and I just can't get my head around this violence that these.
Well, the dark side of self is violent.
Yeah.
And they're being assaulted by this God image.
The really dark part of that story, though, is that there were several adults who knew about it and told them all to keep quiet.
Mm.
And this is just what happened.
Mm. Well, was there a coach on the bus?
Yes.
Three, four.
There were many coaches and many parents and the athletes who were guilty. This is part of being an athlete. This is normal.
And I'm sure it has been done for years. Just hazing, you're hazing people in the way you were hazed.
No, usually it gets a tiny bit worse.
I was thinking about fraternities. I mean, you hear all the stories about what happens in fraternities. My daughter was talking to a man that was quite older. He said, you know, it has been going on forever. He said, 50 years ago when I was on a team, but our idea of doing it was you put pitching powder and a jockstrap.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's what we did.
Power and violence. See, that is the dark side of God.
It's gotten more extreme.
Mm-hmm.
And they came in the first night when he was in the library studying and told, get away from the books, come on, you gotta force the stairs. And my son, who's 6'5", pushed the guy down. That was last beta.
They're just not demanding,
not asking. Mm-hmm. A new freshman.
Mm-hmm.
It waxes and wanes because when I was in college, a fraternity got in trouble for showing essentially a date rape video to try and recruit new members.
To recruit?
Yeah.
Just the kind of numbers you want, huh?
And that's when they were coming down on hazing. That was when there were a number of kids nationwide that were killed in hazing incidents.
Mm-hmm.
So actually, this is less bad than it had been a few years ago.
The whole thing with fraternities, the reason that they haze is because they believe, they all buy into it too, that the harder you have to work for something, the more unified you become. So the idea is that it's you and your pledge brothers against all of the upper classmen, and they make your life miserable, and therefore belonging has value. It's very twisted, and they all will tell you, you know, oh, no, it makes perfect sense.
That's why doctors, we're talking about
doctors. They bring healthcare.
Yeah, they make doctors go through in residency.
Mm-hmm.
That's awful.
Yeah.
To the point where they get mentally affected.
Well, my friend is working 19 hours a day sometimes.
This is awful.
Mm-hmm.
How can they be in any position to heal
people? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What does the patient pay for this?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And it's not just residents. It's once you get out of your residency, you're still expected.
Well, welcome to the dark side of the self.
Yeah.
You get a sense how it's invading our body politic. I think that's one of the implications of this simple sentence that, you see, you could also say there's something godlike in us that doesn't know what it's doing. That's just, all the examples you've given are just an example of that simple sentence.
That's
simple but tragic sentence.
You say God imagine us.
Yeah. We act like God.
Criminals that we just sort of, how can they be that way?
Well, but criminals and God are very close together when it's unconscious. And I was just reading, this book called The Narcissist, it's in the car, Narcissistic Epidemic or something like that. And they gave a case of a guy who murdered, I forget, his daughter or something like that. I mean, it was horrible. And they said that even the prisoners were, something like that, they had to put away from the prisoners because he would have been killed. I mean, even prisoners were outraged. He got like 30 marriage proposals.
What?
Yeah. Letters. So you see how we're fascinated in how relevant this is to, you know, the amoral character of our time. And in Jung's point of view, the reason that is this God image has fallen out of projection and has entered into us, and we're living that out.
And Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde were
happening. It was where it was really living side by side.
Yeah, I think it still is.
When Mary Whitney talks about, you know, in one of her lectures about the Phantom of the Opera and how popular that was and how women just swooned over the Phantom, and that what he was doing was drawing her away from life. You know, and that's just drawn by this mysterious one that would come hither.
Promise you ecstasy.
Weird, violent vampire television show.
Yeah, that are on the kitchen.
Okay, well, that's what we did so far. The two main ideas that I think came out of these pages in Jung's later work, one was this epistemological criticism, and now the dark side of the God image. And we'll see yet another one coming up. Let's see, where are we? We're here. Refinding the Soul, page 231. Remember those visions of the blood and all that he's referring to. When I had the vision of the flood in October of the year 1913, it happened at a time that was significant for me as a man. At that time, in the 40th year of my life, I had achieved everything that I had wished for myself. I had achieved honor, power, wealth, knowledge, and every human happiness. Then my desire for the increase of these trappings ceased. The desire ebbed for me and horror came over me. The vision of the flood seized me and I felt the spirit of the depths that I did not understand. The only thing I'd add, you know, Jung's psychology often states that this individuation process starts at 40.
Midlife crisis.
But that's no longer true. I think it starts, I've seen people where it starts at 18. 17 even.
Would that be because there's just so much more communication?
I think there's more communication, there's much more social collapse, maybe more freedom, maybe it's more desperate. I think a variety of factors. But
well, in containers, I mean, that which contained people.
Is gone.
And they were like, made that major shift, that's all gone?
That's all gone. Yeah. Now this next part, I think we can go kind of quickly through. My soul, where are you? Do you hear me? I speak. I call you. Are you there? That's pretty much the tenor of this page. So for us, it's the discovery of the anima. Remember, we have to always remember Jung didn't have all these ideas at this time. Or the animus in the woman.
So you're equating the animus with the soul?
Well, I mean, technically the animus would be the spirit. But maybe we can avoid that confusion by saying he was discovering an inner being with an autonomy and value equal to his conscious point of view. Look, by contrast, at the bottom of that column, on the first column, I had judged her and turned her into a scientific object. See where I am there at the bottom. That is talking about his first research into the unconscious, which he saw, much like Freud, as a repository, something that was filled up from past hurts. As time went on, and we'll keep this sentence in mind because we're going to see him pretty soon presenting another point of view, that unconscious is an intelligent being in its own right. And just as it is studying, just as we are studying it, it is studying us. And what might really be important is not what we think of it, but what it thinks of us. So he's reversing the centrality of the ego and the unconscious. And again, remember, this was not known when he was writing this, but this is how he started coming upon it.
And that inner thing has more information about us than we do about it, though, right?
Yeah. Ultimately, it's the source of wisdom. And this statement, you know, suggests subject, object, when in fact it's subject, subject. The soul is a subject, and we are a subject. So the idea of categorizing it, though having some validity, also has a limited validity.
So it's not necessarily the source of wisdom, because you said it has to be,
right.
The question is a source.
Yeah, but he almost is going to present it in its flip side here, because he was so much in, we are the only source of wisdom.
Mm-hmm.
And then here you're going to see him struggling to give it its special place, and then realize that there's a reciprocity. Yeah. And I think, you know, that really does fit the analytic process, that and that's why I even hesitate talking about Job sometimes. That often comes much later. You can pretty much trust your dreams at the beginning of the process. And it's like the more you establish a rapport with the unconscious, the more it's willing to give you, both positively and negatively. But I think at the beginning, it's, you can pretty much trust what's there. Unless you're schizophrenic or something, you know, and you have dreams, oh, kill your parents, or kill that person, or something like that.
Gary, we say that the soul is this inner being, but doesn't it exist in the world as...
Yeah, but see, he was nowhere close to that. Nowhere close to that.
At this point,
he didn't realize
synchronicities and...
No. He's just at this point, he's realizing, holy smokes, I have developed a power attitude, and I need to change that. And that Freudian psychology is based on a power attitude. Remember that dictum, where it is, there let ego be? Did you ever hear that in Psych 101? Might be worth putting up. It's from, it's one of the classic sentences of Freud.
That sentence sums up Freud in much. Where it is, there let ego be. In other words, what is unconscious should be replaced by consciousness. It is the drives. So you in becoming conscious, once you were driven, you have replaced that with a consciousness that makes decisions. That makes sense? That's his basic point of view. But see, it puts the emphasis on the ego.
You say that's Freud?
That's Freud.
So that's no room for the...
No room for the id, which of course Jung then redefines as the unconscious, to have an intelligence and purpose and autonomy of its own. Ego is the final authority.
So could we say that for Freud, the unconscious is this machine that keeps pumping out energy in the form of drive?
Yeah, and then we got to get control of it.
Okay.
He doesn't even have the unconscious. He said the subconscious, right?
Right.
Right. Everything is once conscious, but now it's not.
Right.
There's nothing there of its own accord.
Right.
And you can always tell if you're talking to a Freudian, because they'll say subconscious.
Will they?
Instead of unconscious.
Huh. Mm-hmm. So I think he kind of repeats a little bit over to the second, third paragraph on the second column of 232. And he gets into this, really, I think, quite an advanced idea. The relationship between desire for the world and soul. And that is a thorny one. I'll try to sum it up. Those last two paragraphs on page 232. The idea is a paradox. You have to get your hands dirty in desire for the world. See, there it is totally anti-Christian, anti-Buddhist, I think anti-Hindu. Maybe even anti-religion.
Is that just anti-materialism?
No, it is materialism.
Yeah, that's what I meant.
Yeah. He's saying the world's not here to avoid it. Get out there, live your desires, get what you want. Almost greed is good. But what happens when you do that? You fall into despair. Because it's not satisfying. And what is left is understanding the meaning of your desire. In other words, getting dream images of the desire and understanding what those dream images tell you about your growth. Now, remember, this is at 40. At 60, hopefully you've done that a few times and you realize, whoa, I think I'll be a little more careful next time. But the idea is to extend value to desire as a means of self-knowledge. And the one danger is that you don't desire anything. You flee from life thanks to religion. The other danger is all you do is pursue material satisfaction. Both are equally destructive. Because if you don't pursue the world, you'll never have the chance to get the images communicated through desire. If you only pursue the material, you also won't get the images communicated through desire, because you won't be listening. And the soul is enhanced through the lessons that come from pursuing what you want and learning from it. That's how I would sum up that paragraph. It's the difference between going after something and getting the image from your dreams that represents what you're going after as a message for your growth and development.
So can an individual experience a personal sort of spirit of the times for spirit of the depth?
Sure. You could almost say that the materialism is the spirit of the time, and that we're all caught up in it.
Well, for some people, I mean, there's this this move towards simplicity that is really becoming like a religion,
mm-hmm.
where you're
composting and you're growing your own food and you're only buying locally and you're not having television and you're not having modern amenities, and it is better for the environment and it's probably a healthier way to live, but it takes an enormous amount of time and energy. Mm-hmm. And a lot of my friends are making their own laundry soap and they say, well, it only takes 20 minutes. Well, it takes 5 to buy Tide. Mm-hmm. So, you know, this balance, but they're like, no, you have to, and there's no wiggle room. It's like they've somehow mm-hmm. really failed if they give
That's
in.
That's very smart. Perception. Because here is the problem, I think, with enforced desire limitation. You turn self-righteous.
It's
the
third danger, right?
You could say it's a third danger. Yeah.
It also becomes another fad. I mean, it's like, you know, it's now fad to do that.
And it may not have sustaining power.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's why he went this route. Even Mother Teresa said, if you want a Porsche, go buy a Porsche. Stop buying Porsches when you're sick of Porsches. Because then you don't point at other people who are driving Porsches. If you don't buy a Porsche when you want a Porsche and you see a Porsche, you will say, oh, you're a horrible person. And if you have bought a Porsche and are sick of Porsches, you see a Porsche, you say, well, I have other interests.
So that would be an Andromeda of the materialism, but it would still...
I think her case is the enantiodromia. That you say you want to create a better world, and you end up spreading guilt.
What's the judgment in here?
Pardon?
The judgment?
Yeah. It's funny, I certainly sympathize with green consciousness, and it's something we have to reach. But every time I hang around those types, I have bad dreams. It's like another, you shouldn't have sex. It's another moralistic thing. Rather, how do we get to the point where we want to do that? That, I think, is what Jung is working with. And then that sort of change can be sustained. Because when it's a should, pretty soon the should not in the next generation is going to take its revenge.
Or there's excess in some other way. You know,
yeah.
The same people will take a driving vacation, you know, to to a kibbutz in Wyoming, or, you know, and not think, it not be any hypocrisy in the amount of fossil fuel it takes to get here. Or, you know, I mean, sort of to me, it seems like when you buy carbon offsets, you're doing the same thing. Well, I'll throw money at it so that I don't have to feel bad about doing what I know is not good. I would rather you just do it and admit that you're going to do it.
Yeah. Well, I think what Jung is trying to do here, I don't know, I don't think he intended it, but what he is doing is trying to find a way for real change to occur that can be sustained. On an individual level, of course, because he's working as a psychiatrist. But I think it would apply socially as well. I mean, look at my generation. I told some of you guys, the biggest SDS, remember the Secret Students for Democratic Service, the big radical group in the 60s? The biggest SDS guy on campus now makes commercials for SUVs.
Look at the whole 60s group. In the 68th one in Chicago.
They're probably real estate brokers or something.
Well, and then the stockbrokers.
Uh-huh.
Or they tell themselves, like the Amy Bachman and Jerry Rubin.
Did they kill
them? They didn't both kill themselves.
They died young, though, didn't they? Or something? Yeah.
Advocate for the homeless, they killed themselves in a relationship.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like they either went back.
Well, you get a sense, hopefully, why he's playing with this thing of desire and meaning and soul. I think, you know, in our time, generally, it's a materialistic time, people flee to material seeking the soul. And they don't get it, so they get a bigger material, a bigger, you know, whatever. Better, more. so that we're in a time of quantity. Where this, I think, if it's lived consciously, leads to quality. So it's pretty easy to get sick of all the greed. But I think Jung is saying you can't transform greed directly without it eventually leading back to itself. You've got to accept it, work with the images that come, and that leads to a transformation. And remember, he would be like at 40, like a yuppie today in a McMansion, you might say. He lived in that huge house. His wife was stinking rich. You know, he had everything. And then he realized, but in a way, I have nothing. That's where he then turned to the meaning of what he had. Yeah, what did he do at this point, or shortly after this? Rather than build a bigger house, he built a smaller house down in Bali.
So for some, the simplicity movement could be the right direction, but for others, it's just a chasing after the people who are...
I just see it as another form of moralism. First, sex was bad. Now, material is bad. And what we're getting out of Jung's work is, you know, if you don't do something because it's bad, it will take its revenge.
Did
you
give up his big house?
No.
He just found other ways to express himself.
And I think used what he had accomplished mm-hmm. as the basis for finding deeper value.
Mm-hmm. Right. He saw the value in having those things
right.
that enabled him to do this.
Absolutely, yeah.
He couldn't have done this.
He could have done this if he were a poor boy. Mm-hmm. It, you know, you don't make money writing. He spent a lot of time writing. Mm-hmm. Okay, so I think that's...
I think that it's important that the image seems central in this as the language between soul and ego.
Yes, yeah. And yeah, that's the gift he's giving, I think.
That the image is the language between the soul and the ego, that it's central in the process, that we have to learn how to read it. Right.
Yeah, learn how to read it and learn what it takes to get it. You get it by being in the world.
And could we say that for each person, then the image will be unique to them? And
yeah.
That's why he was saying there isn't a formula.
Right.
This is an individual process.
Right.
Okay.
Well, that was the picture. Do we want to brainstorm that anymore? We spent a little time on it. This is the picture for the section we just did. Or the what's the word? Something good. H-I. Historiated initial. Thank you.
Yeah,
maybe just we could spend a bit. Just, we talked about it last time, but it wouldn't hurt. Yeah, turn them off. Just to let it sink in.
Yeah. That's the one where Kathy said the flowers had become golden.
Mm-hmm. You could say flowers would be the desire for the world producing the gold.
That
one? Producing the gold.
Oh,
and they look fall-like in that they're not gold. The ones within the being are fall-like. Not there.
Well, she saw them as gold.
Right.
Oh, I see.
Too.
Yeah.
The gold is not in the producing chlorophyll, producing seed time. It's in the coming down.
Yeah. The harvest, maybe.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think these little details are incredibly important. So what we have just described... The picture shows as a flower going to harvest. The bird, of course, would be the dot, would be the soul. Okay.
But you were talking more about the idea of meaning being gold, right?
finding meaning in desire. Or
the yeah, part. That's we're saying the same thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a beautiful picture, I think.
Mm-hmm. And as Patty mentioned, the 3 and 4 of the red flower.
Uh-huh. Now that, I don't think he would have, I don't think he had 3 and 4 straight by then. So that's purely out of the unconscious. And, you know, you can take in picture interpretation, which is one of my weaknesses, going from left to right as past to future. So that the movement of the picture, you could say, is 3 to 4. Why the soul is going this way?
I see it as going up. I don't know why, but
okay.
That's just my imagination.
Well, your imagination counts.
It's rising
mm-hmm.
from below. See, not coming down. To me, it's not coming down from above. It's
rising from below.
From below.
It's almost like the dove is activating. Four flowers.
Well, you have a point because that's more the wing pose, too. If it was coming down, usually they're more like this.
Okay.
Brilliant.
I don't know.
I'm sorry. You have to take a compliment.
Thank you.
Jungians are the only people you have to apologize to when you compliment them.
No inflation.
No inflation attendant. Okay, well, that's that section. Here's the next image. Soul and God. But we can probably... Or do you want to just chew on that maybe before we get started? Or would you rather hear it and then... Or maybe both. Fantasize the beginning, we'll hear the section, and you can fantasize at the end.
Can I ask a question before we
yeah.
On footnote 40, which is at the... it says that Jung called the process of turning away from outer things introversion of the libido.
Right.
And does libido mean the same thing for him that it does for Freud?
No. For Jung, you could substitute energy.
Oh, okay.
And the difference is both recognized energy. When Freud uses the word libido, he refers to a sexual energy, and Jung doesn't necessarily mean it has to have a quality.
Okay. That's all.
The sexual could be one aspect of Jung's idea of libido.
I thought there was a marked difference in the style of this letter
yeah.
compared to the others. I'm not really sure how to describe it, but when I first saw it, it felt serpentine to me. Of course, it's an S, so mm-hmm. that helps, but what he did with the ends...
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah, it was more animal-like.
I thought it was
organic,
too. Mm-hmm.
Very organic, yeah.
What was that, Anne? I didn't...
Seahorse.
Uh-huh.
It does have that quality.
Well, the interesting thing is about the seahorse, though, is that in the male carries the pregnancy in seahorses, and so, you know, he's pregnant with these ideas, and he's going through this transformation, and a new way of living is coming about, and that would be one way that he, as a male, could express that through the seahorse.
Yeah, there's something womb-like about those two shapes. Particularly, that's almost like a womb itself, isn't it? You looked at a woman standing up crosswise
yeah.
here, birth canal.
One of the devil's in one part and the snake is in the other.
I thought the snake was in the womb. I thought that was the womb.
Yeah, this, you think this is the womb?
Actually, yeah, both of them.
Yeah. That's sort of positive and negative.
Yeah.
So this, the
yin and yang.
Underside and the higher side of the soul of both sides.
Yeah.
Carol said the yin and the yang. You've got the light and the warm and the dark.
Yeah, you know, just somebody, whatever, who said it, sort of triggered in me, that the snake would be, you know, the desire, and the bird would be the meaning. Mm-hmm. And, you know, compare that with the Garden of Eden, where the snake is the bad boy. Here, he's in relationship with the spirit, or she's in relationship with the spirit.
Is the dove's head looking down, or is that, am I just seeing that wrong?
No, you're right.
Mm-hmm. It's looking down, mm-hmm. like you're, instead of, usually they're looking straight ahead. Or
mm-hmm. Now there it does look like he's landing, would you say?
Yes.
Yeah.
That's the classic pose of the dove in all the church windows.
Oh, is it?
Mm-hmm.
So he's descending in the church windows, huh?
Mm-hmm. I took it as he was flying away, because you could see his feet behind him. And that might be a personal interpretation for me, because I had like a dream of a stag running behind a hill that mm-hmm. I was supposed to follow. So to me, that was, he's, the spirit is moving and I was supposed to follow.
You know, certainly possible.
I was looking at it as looking down mm-hmm. to the desire to learn more himself. But,
I think all of these are relevant. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Even though a dove's not a bird of prey, but birds of prey do often eat snakes, and so a hawk would come in, landing with its talons out. I mean, that it's mm-hmm. almost as though it's coming to grasp, so that there's going to be a melding of this.
Could be.
And even the tree looks super tall.
Yeah, you know, it's funny, I tell you, I really do not, my mind does not work in picture interpretation, but I didn't even see that tree.
Oh.
But that would be the tree, and yeah. Tree of life, and that's the serpent, it must be.
Yeah, let's see.
Did you figure that out already?
Mm-hmm.
I almost failed my picture interpretation.
But I just went totally off of this bird.
Yeah, go.
But when I looked at the last figure, I see that the beak and the talons are both red. But when I saw this one, I didn't see them as talons. I saw them as blood, and that somehow he is going to have to go, he's going through a blood experience. So that's where
the dove, huh?
Yeah. His soul.
Mm-hmm.
His soul. Because is it about this time that he meets Tony, or is it?
Before.
Before, okay.
About this time it might have been heating up.
Yeah, okay. So that's where
I should check on that, actually. I'm not sure, Sandy.
Yeah, I'd love to know. I really
I'll make
he it. Does mention it over here about him.
Mm-hmm. Well, he says he learned about his soul from a woman.
Right. And that's gotta be her.
That's gotta be her.
Is it in that chronological
I don't think it is, but
the other thing that struck me, and that might be the people migrants, but you cannot see the roots of that tree. Whereas you see other pictures of trees sometimes, even I think our symbol for Central Indiana Friends of Young, you see the tree up above and the roots down below. You can't see the roots of that tree.
Maybe it isn't rooted yet.
Well, that's, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You guys are good.
Doesn't that snake look coiled?
Yeah, it looks ominous.
Ready to. Is it one or two?
Just one.
I wondered about that too,
Tammy.
I think it's supposed to be one.
Mm-hmm. It looks ready to stream.
When they were saying pregnant, I thought maybe the snake's pregnant.
Oh. Or just eaten. It would look
like
a
snake. They do look.
It just has to be a belt to me.
It does have a big bulb.
Mm-hmm.
A big bulb.
Is it fair? Yeah. Is it fair to say that there's even a duality to the dark side, because there's a dark side that wants to stay dark, and there's the part that wants to
to be present.
Or there's the, in a strange way, the helpful aspect of destructiveness. You don't like that?
No.
I don't either, but unfortunately, I've had to deal with it.
Well, what's that thing about the Trinity,
the Lower Trinity? I don't...
You know, that there's the...
I don't think we have it yet, but... yeah, that would be it, Jane. I think typically the lower Trinity would be the what we've said, in other words, as the meaning of instinctual experience. But instinctual experience can be positive or negative. So that would fit.
Tammy just suggested that perhaps the snake is just eaten. And
yeah.
It would be a very instinctual.
Yeah. I think it's pretty safe to say this snake is that instinctual desire for the world. And where in Judaism it's the beginning of the fall, Jung is showing us whatever else he's saying as intimately tied to the spirit.
And because it's like they're separate from each other. You know, there's a barrier between them at this point.
So, what do you reckon that means? If you take it about Jung, personally. Yeah, I think he was feeling horrible about his affair. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he said, I damn near committed suicide. Many times I was swimming in the lake and I thought, I just drowned, I'll save a lot of people a lot of misery. So I think his working on this, how can I put it, his psychology was an attempt to solve that problem, to realize how bad desire can actually have a positive meaning. So there's the desire and the meaning, mm-hmm. which are, at this point in his life, separate.
Yeah,
yeah, at odds with each other. But what he strove to understand was how they are linked to each other.
And that's interesting, and the S is gold.
Whatever the bottom seeds in it,
whatever
it is, yeah,
and
whatever
connects
to what
you see,
mm-hmm.
the gold.
Oh, that's just the artifact of the praying process.
Oh, it is really?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because this is so, you're just seeing the dot printing matrix here.
Oh, really?
Are you sure?
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty large for.
That's pretty large for. Yeah, you sure?
Are we talking about the speckledy and nothing else?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I thought that was the glitter of the paint, maybe, or something.
Yeah, it's actually two colors.
Mm-hmm. Well, at least.
Because if you go back to the gold in the one with the flowers that are gold, it's...
You can't see all the dots in every aspect yes. of those colors?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's the printing.
Gold.
Yeah, that I see, but that I see a speckled in the S.
Yeah,
me
too.
It's there too. Mm-hmm.
Well,
same speckle.
Mm-hmm. But that's a bigger speckle mm-hmm. in the S.
Well, part of it is that printing process, and then there's the texture of that gold paint, which is really thick.
That's where I was going with it. Yeah.
Now, alchemically, have you studied alchemy yet?
No.
No, okay. So I wonder if that was interpreted alchemy.
No, this is all. See, alchemy. I don't think alchemy came really into his awareness until 1928. That was pretty late. First, before that, it was Gnosticism, if I'm correctly informed. I believe that's right. He probably knew about it. I think he might have started collecting these texts, you know, that he worked on. But he had no clue about its subtleties, certainly. Well, show you a stretch.
In German, what does it stand for?
Yes, Seele. Soul in God. Seele.
Oh.
Soul and God. That's the next section, page 233.